Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about another terrific podcast called Historically Thinking. It's hosted by Al Zambone, a historian, and every week Al talks to historians about how they do their work and about their books and about history in general. This is a wonderful podcast, and it's one of our favorites at the New Books Network, and I really encourage you to subscribe to Historically Thinking. You can go to historicallythinking.org and learn all about it. It's on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe there, and we'd like to give you a little taste of Historically Thinking, so we're going to republish some of Al's terrific episodes, such as the one that follows. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Historically Thinking, program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. Once upon a time in America, there were department stores. Each city had its particular favorites. Macy's in New York, and only in New York. Weinstock's in Sacramento. Woodrow and Lothrop in Washington, D.C. And Wanamaker's and Strawbridge and Clothier in Philadelphia. But there were many others, smaller perhaps, but even more pervasive, scattered in every good-sized town in America. Lazarus in Middlebury, Vermont. Bergner's in Freeport, Illinois. And the Zambone store of Vineland and Bridgeton, New Jersey. The department store, its rise and its decline, is the subject of my guest Vicki Howard's study, From Main Street to Mall, The Rise and Fall of the American Department Store. Vicki Howard is professor of history at Hartwick College in Oneonta, New York. Her previous book was an outstanding read, and particularly timely this season, is Brides Incorporated, American Weddings and the Business of Tradition. Also, both were published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. She is, among many other things, editor of the journal History of Retailing and Consumption, and we're very glad to have her speaking with us today. Thank you, Vicki.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very happy to be talking with you, Al.
So, as I alluded to in the introduction, I actually have when I saw that your book was coming out and I saw that it was about Main Street department stores, I had to talk to you because I have a personal connection to this.
I'm very interested to hear about that.
Yeah, I haven't gotten autobiographical on this podcast before, but my great-grandmother, within about 10 or 15 years of arriving in America, started to sell, as best as I can make out from the family stories, sewing supplies. Out of her, basically, her room, their rooms in an apartment. And that soon developed into a business, which at its height was, extremely regional in southern New Jersey, about four stores, two large mm-hmm. ones and two small ones, which sold dry goods. And that lasted until my grandfather closed in about 1965. So I think that those dates from about 1890 to 1965 track beautifully with the heart of your story.
Yes, absolutely. And I guess were they Italian Americans?
They were Italian Americans. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Yeah, often the early department stores were founded by immigrants and, you know, started in a very small scale. Sometimes the entrepreneur was a peddler,
yeah,
who would then get a storefront and eventually expand and either have, you know, multiple units like your grandmother eventually had and her family had, or you know, perhaps that they would expand on Main Street and end up with a multi-storied building. But that's a very familiar trajectory that I wrote about in the beginning of my book.
Yeah, let's start there. It does, by the way, it now in New Urbanism, there's a great concept of the pop-up store, which tests out a market. It makes me realize that in an era of really of absolutely minimal to no regulation of the 1890s, everyone could run a pop-up store. Or
yes,
peddle something.
Absolutely.
See if it works.
Although there were campaigns against peddlers and against street vendors, you know, from the mainstream merchants. So
sure.
I guess they didn't go without opposition.
No.
Always.
I remember those in the 1970s and 1980s, of course, in Philadelphia. Those were quite heated even then about the various street peddlers. But let's start back in the 1890s, 1905. Department stores, like everything else, have a history. When does their history begin?
Well, actually, historians debate the origins of the department store, and different countries claim origin. And so it's actually not a, you would think it would be an easy question to answer, you know, when did something begin?
Yeah.
What was the first store? But there's not a lot of agreement. I think historians sometimes, you know, get caught up on those types of questions. And, you know, without spending too much time answering it, I would say that it evolved slowly over the second half of the 19th century and was fully formed by the 1890s. And there was sort of a transitional period, you know, in the 1870s. But 1870s and 80s, you start seeing some of the names that we're familiar with now.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the names that you mentioned in your introduction. In the United States, that's sort of the date. I think the French claimed that the Bon Marché was the first department store, and that's from 1869.
Uh-huh.
And England has Whiteley's, which is also earlier than that.
Uh-huh.
But you could roughly say the second half of the 19th century, the department store form evolved. And I think the term itself began to be used in the 1890s. Before that, it was not used. One of the earliest stores that I write about is A.T. Stewart's, which was, he was an Irish immigrant and started in the 1840s in New York City. And I guess he didn't really call it a department store, but we can look at it as the origins of that. He had many of the features, but was missing one of the main categories that we usually associate with department stores, and that he did not sell furniture. It was mostly a dry goods emporium, a departmentalized dry goods emporium.
So I guess this we have to ask the question here. What is a department store? You just said it. They usually,
yes, and you know, before you had department stores, you had single line merchants dominating the scene, meaning that the merchant would sell one line of goods, and they would specialize. And department stores were very different in that they pulled together many different lines under one roof. You know, they would advertise as, you know, having everything under the sun, you know, and all the services on top of that and amenities that came to be associated with a luxurious urban institution.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the Census Bureau has its own definition, you know, it would be sort of a full line of household goods as well as women's apparel and men's apparel, you know, with some size as the minimum requirement for becoming a department store. But I think in my book, I don't really pay attention too much to those types of real strict categories.
Mm-hmm.
If the business is calling themselves a department store, I include them, even though they might be a small town, a Main Street store that would look more like what you would generally think of as a general store or a mm-hmm. country store.
Yeah.
In some of the smaller towns around 1900, you have these department stores, but they're not the multi-stored, lavish palaces of consumption like Marshall Field's in Chicago or Wanamaker's in Philadelphia or Macy's in New York. They're much more modest, but they're still identified with the industry and, you know, subscribing to the trade journals and following all the latest merchandising advice from the industry and belonging to the trade groups and going to New York City to do their buying. And they're looking forward, and they consider themselves progressive merchants, even though they may only have like $100,000 in business.
Yeah, what do they mean by progressive merchants?
Well, yeah, that's a word that you see a lot associated with the turn of the century.
Sure, everything.
Merchants.
Everything is progressive.
And I think that meant, to them, it meant modern, maybe trying to get away from the dependence on credit that those earlier country merchants might have had, where they followed a policy of open book credit, where you wouldn't settle your account up regularly. You would, you know, sort of settle it as you could, and that's something that's usually tied to a rural economy, and it's very difficult to expand with that type of, you know, debt and lack of capital.
We should almost underline that point. It's something I'm always trying to explain to undergraduates. The lack of the fact that there was a credit economy, because, well, the American, I'm teaching the American colonies, right? That's my period, so that it's officially a cash deprived society under imperial rule. So everything works by credit, and that extends really up until gold and silver starts flowing from the West in the late 19th century, right?
Yeah, and the early department stores were cash only businesses, and some of the luxurious ones would have special charge accounts they might give to their wealthy customers, but generally, like, for example, Macy's was well known as a cash-only store. Mm-hmm. And, that was sort of seen as a progressive way of doing business, getting away from that dependence on credit. And then also following, scientific management techniques and, sort of using things like the cash register. That was seen as a modern innovation that would, prevent pilfering and would speed up the transactions, and so these small town merchants started to identify with the industry as professionals in the field, and get a little bit away from sort of their country store roots.
Was there
in smaller towns
an emphasis on hygiene or cleanliness, or that seems
the brands that were that they advocated in their grocery departments, for example, or maybe this would be maybe more applied to the stores that had grocery lines, they made those kinds of appeals that you would have packaged goods rather than bulk goods that could be contaminated, by handling. And department stores actually advocated private brands, though, over national brands. They eventually, had their own, they came up with their own brands to pull people in, pull customers in, and you would get to know that, for example, later on, Sears was known for the Kenmore brand. That's their own private brand. And also to compete with the national brands that sometimes had price, suggested retail prices that they had to follow. They could get around that by having their own brands rather than following the ones that the national manufacturers were pushing.
Yeah, the only department store, the sort of that reminds me of these that I've ever been to is Marks and Spencer's in England. And that is where you'll have everything in two stories and relatively small, certainly a very small footprint by modern American standards. But it's what they're promising you is this is the best possible that you can buy of anything. And that's, still their reputation that they try to cultivate in Britain. This is where you only one scrub brush in the small departments, in the small grocery section of the department. It's going to be the best scrub brush you can possibly get. Right. And that's what the department stores did from the very beginning.
I'm amazed at how many lines of goods that these early department stores had. In my book, I have an illustration from Hilton Hughes and Company that just lists the departments that were in this 1890s New York department store. And, it dwarfs what we have in our stores today. It's like looking at those Sears catalogs from the turn of the century and seeing, the massive amounts of goods that were available, in the Victorian period and the early 20th century. I actually think we have fewer. I think we almost have, you know, fewer choices, even though on some levels we have more choices. But
yeah.
Like you're looking at silverware from that time period, you know, there's a specialized piece of silverware for every single imaginable thing, like an asparagus fork or a pickle fork or berry spoon.
Yeah, that's a puzzler right there, the strawberry spoon. I didn't realize levels of specialization had gotten that far in tableware. So they were replacing these single line merchants. They were being destroyed by the
They were challenging them. That's for sure. Because they could undersell them. The department stores had economies of scale. They were able to, run their business in efficient ways and have access to quantity discounts from manufacturers, and they could centralize various functions of the store in a way that a mom and pop business wouldn't be able to do, and they could, offer lower prices to customers as a result. In addition, they could compete with amenity and, luxury in a way that a smaller store couldn't. And so the smaller single-line merchants objected to department stores, and there was actually something, people have called the store wars in the late 19th century, where there were protests against department stores, and they were sort of the Walmart of their era, and viewed as threatening the small business.
Yeah.
And there were efforts to raise taxes against them, to have laws limiting what they could do, and all of those oppositional tactics failed, and department stores, won out at the turn of the century. But I think the lesson, a lesson was learned, I think, for historians that, that these types of conflicts, they're deeply rooted in various, they're deeply rooted, and I think you can see them emerging, in recent years. We've seen campaigns against Walmart, and one of the arguments is that Walmart destroys small towns and destroys small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really nothing new. This was what was happening to department stores.
So,
in addition, the other mass retailers, like the mail order catalog companies, were also seen as a major threat to the small business at the end of the 19th century.
This would seem to be part then of the how shall we say? It's part of the an epiphenomenon of the business cycle. This is going on. It's also a part of a social and cultural cycle that's attached to the business cycle.
Yeah, and they're not the same. They occur in different contexts, and they have they have different meaning as well, tied to the specific circumstances of the period. But I think that it's interesting to see some of the parallels.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I've been struck by the similarities of arguments, controversy, or Amazon with Sears and Montgomery Ward and all the other catalog firms. Back at the same in the same period.
Yeah, and there were efforts to contain that through legislation, and there were efforts in the past as well to try to contain these developments with legislation.
Yeah, you point out that we have in the nostalgia. These are all very unique places that are very rooted in their particular city or their community. But their holding companies emerge very early on. Talk about that, please.
Yes, I guess I'm making an argument that we're nostalgic for these downtown department stores that are not with us no longer, and we see them as local institutions because they originated in particular cities and mm-hmm. their nameplate adorned the buildings for maybe 100 years. But I'm also pointing out that. And my reason for doing this is to show that change happened a lot earlier than we might think. We might think of this as a recent phenomenon,
right.
Maybe stemming from the 2005 merger of the two largest department store chains federated in May in 2005, which ultimately led to all of the stores that were merged being renamed either Bloomingdale's or Macy's.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Macy's are so ubiquitous, because of that merger. But I think the transformation... is much more historical and deeply rooted in, the rise of big business. And you can see the creation of these chains of department stores. stores earlier. You know, some of the first mergers were, well, one of the big mergers was in the late 1920s. Mm-hmm. But you had all the way through the 20th century various efforts to benefit from merging or acquiring other stores and have, you know, more economies of scale and and more efficiencies. For example, if by 1929, chain department stores were 17% of their market. So already, you know, even in this sort of heyday of the local department store, the independent department store that's downtown, it's run by its founding family, you still already have 17% of those are multi-unit. Mm-hmm. And after World War II, about 50% of the department store market consisted of chain department stores. And then when you switch to the 1970s, there was, you know, even greater consolidation. Just three of the big chain department stores, Sears, Montgomery Ward's, and JCPenney's, those three chains alone in the mid-70s made up about, oh, about 43% of department store sales. Wow. Then.
Wow.
And by the 80s, it was almost 100%, about 97-98% of department stores were chains by the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. But this was an unending pressure to create an economy of scale, which of course goes with the very logic of forming department stores in the first place. Let's back up a little bit. How did they change the downtowns of American cities? The fact of those department stores.
Well, department stores are urban institutions. You know, the biggest palaces of consumption in the 19th century were in major cities, like, you know, like Marshall Field's in Chicago and Philadelphia, and then in New York City, Boston, and there were, you know, all different ways of you know, buying goods in big cities, but the department stores, it would pull in so much trade that they would shape the business districts of those cities, and pretty much other retailers and other kinds of businesses would follow them. So they create, you know, fashionable retailing districts, and when they move, the retail district follows them. Mm-hmm. And moves with them. So they have an effect on the geography of the commercial geography in that way. And so they're urban institutions, and they spread to smaller cities and then small towns even. As you mentioned earlier, about 1900, main streets across the country would have something that would be called a department store. And mm-hmm. again, these would, you know, offer a lot of competition for smaller stores, but they would also provide a real center for people to go and socialize and eat at the restaurants. Yeah. And spend their free time, because department stores were not just places to shop, they were also places to gather with other people. Mm-hmm. You know, in a public place. And you know, they featured from the very beginning, they featured tea rooms and restrooms. Yeah. And restaurants that would attract people, and the shoppers often were women. Women were the major shopper that department stores sought to appeal to in the late 19th century, and they had amenities catering to women, like some of the big department stores that of the 19th century would advertise having places for the women to sit to rest their feet on a day of shopping. Women would go there and spend the day there. And meet with their friends. And so they are really social centers of the city.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com newbooks.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
As a small child, I remember the Wanamakers that existed before the, it had already begun the endless series of mergers that would eventually lead to its collapse. I remember some of those, that things would always change after each merger. They would get a little worse. But I remember the dizzying variety of different stores within the store. I mean, it was like being in a modern shopping mall.
You're mentioning Wanamaker, and that, they were known for their organ.
Yeah, absolutely.
They would have concerts for people.
Yeah, with the Christmas light show. I mean, it's like the chief event of a child in the Philadelphia area was going into Wanamaker's to watch the Christmas light show. I still do it, and they haven't changed that. It's still there.
Yeah. In the 1920s, they all had radio stations.
Yeah.
They would put a radio station up at the top of the store, and so some of the earliest broadcasting came out of department stores, and they would they would develop programming that would.
That's right. That's the first station in Pittsburgh. So it was direct marketing of the earliest variety.
Yeah, and then you could also go to the department store to buy a radio,
of course,
with which to listen to the radio station.
So these are. They become hubs of the, and so they're becoming, they're actually representing the downtown to the entire metropolitan area around it. So they're becoming a regional center as well as a city center.
Yes, I think people would come in from the country to shop. And, I'm sort of emphasizing their inclusivity and their, people have talked about the democracy of goods that were created by these department stores. They were able to lower prices, and they had bargain basements, like Filene's Bargain Basement was founded around 1908, 1909.
Yeah.
And so, even people of lesser means could afford them. But at the same time, there were limitations, I think, to that democracy. And, mostly in the South, but also in the North, I think department stores, like many other public places, discriminated against people of color. You'd be able to go to the tea room and to the restaurant if you were white, but if you were African American, you would probably be turned away.
Yeah.
And so I also, in my book, look in the 1950s and 60s at the protests that center on department stores as places of segregation for shopping, but also as places that segregate in terms of employment. And there were campaigns that, Rich's department store, Foley's department store, Thalheimer's, Miller & Rhodes, all the major stores in the South had to change their ways as a result of African-American-led civil rights movements and sit-ins and then to comply with the law, sort of slowly they made some changes after the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
They do have a
history also of discrimination and segregation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Woodrow and Lothrop in D.C. wouldn't take Jewish customers.
Although a lot of department store merchants were German Jews,
so that's always fascinated me that there are a few that wouldn't. What's the role of the New Deal to the department store?
Yes, I have a chapter on the. I go chronologically, and because I think that every era posed new challenges for the department store industry in terms of what consumers wanted, how the business was developing, and then I also look at the role of state and federal and local policy in shaping the industry.
Yeah.
And in the 30s, the Depression cut back on department stores' markets, obviously, but also the department stores were sort of at first supportive of some of the policies like the NRA, but then quickly turned their back on the NRA and FDR and sort of fought some of the regulations that were coming out of the New Deal. So I look at that. I look at that period as a sort of a period of negotiation where the industry is, you know, which is traditionally quite conservative and opposing what they call government intervention. They're learning to sort of deal with a larger state and accommodating it to begin with, and then maybe also turning their back on it.
Yeah, or engaging in what the economists would call rent-seeking behavior, ways of trying to preserve their status.
And in World War II, it would become even more the case with the Office of Price Administration, mm-hmm. With the limits on prices. Department stores who like to set their own prices had to comply with the regulations and. But at the same time, they wanted to support the war effort, and they did a lot to support the war effort, engaging actually in war bond campaigns, and also contributing a lot of labor. A lot of leadership during the war came out of the department store industry.
Yeah, my father, in fact, one of the stories used to fascinate me as a kid when during the war, when my father was a small boy. Wanamaker's on their eighth floor, which I knew as the toy department. Basically, I don't know how in the world they did this, but they moved basically a variety of fighter aircraft up to the eighth floor.
And you
could walk around and sit in them. And I think that every day they would have Tommy gun demonstrations, and someone would fire a submachine gun into an enormous bale of cotton at the end of
really? A fire.
Yeah, much to the delight of every all children present, I guess.
Yeah, I bet.
I mean, it gets to their, I guess, that role that you describe of them trying to be leaders of the war propaganda effort, the war mobilization effort, and all the rest of it.
Yes.
So then the car, the suburb, which seems to me is the department stores are pushed. They reach into the suburbia. I guess looking back, that seems to be a moment of that. Well, looking back, we know that's a moment of profound change, and maybe the beginning of the end. How do you see that?
Yes, I mean the automobile transforms the commercial landscape, in many ways, and it affects many of the cities that were, of course, built as pedestrian cities, or were not easily able to accommodate cars. Parking was always a challenge for these retailers, and the rise of the branch store in the post-war period is in part a response to what are perceived as the lack of parking in the city, as well as a perceived lack of or a sort of decline of cities and people's interest in. I should say white middle class consumers' interest in living in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And so department stores are seeking that market, and they follow the demographics. They go out to the city, out of the city, into the suburbs, into the shopping centers that are springing up all over the country. And so I look at the effect of suburbia on department stores. And the branch stores, when they first start going to the shopping centers, they're seen as sort of a way to add on to the parent store downtown. They're not seen as a competitor, although it becomes quickly apparent that they're pulling away trade from the downtown. So the downtown stores, those 19th century stores that had long been the focus of their shoppers, they lose market share, mm-hmm. and the industry starts to pay less attention to them, and the facilities start to decline, and the new shiny suburban stores are seen as, the new form of retailing, sort of mm-hmm. the new innovation. And at the same time, we have discount stores appearing in the post-war World War II period, and those are also competitors for department stores in this era, and that also changes the market mix.
What are the names of some of those discount stores?
Corvettes with a K is a major one. There's one called Two Guys.
Oh yeah,
literally like Two Guys.
I remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah, and But some of the ones that we're most familiar with today were founded in 1962. Target, Kmart, and Walmart were all founded in 1962. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of a real heyday for the discount store.
It seems to me there's also some changing patterns of consumption as well. I know that my great-grandmother's store, my grandfather's store, there were dry goods stores, but they were... It was aimed at women who were able to sew, make their own clothes, and that's the ready-to-wear market. They had ready-to-wear stuff, but they always had lots and lots of raw materials, as it were. But of course, that's changing radically after the war.
There was sort of a resurgence of home sewing, I think, mm-hmm. in the post-war period. Ready to wear for women was a major department line for these emporia, starting in the teens, and for men earlier. Men's ready to wear was much earlier than women's. Women's clothing was closely fitted and mm-hmm. difficult to mass produce.
Yeah, we don't.
So there was a lot of home sewing and dressmaker sewing. Yeah. For women's fashions in the early 20th century. But, so ready-to-wear was fully in place by World War II, but I think in the post-war period there was a resurgence of home sewing.
Right.
And so those dry goods sections and notion sections were mm-hmm. probably quite popular. And mm-hmm. that was what your family store specialized in, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so there's a post-war resurgence. All right, that's interesting. The discount revolution, that starts to drive...
It really worries the department store merchants because they're starting to lose their hold on the market. And so, like in late 1920s, that's when we have the first business census that really keeps track of these kinds of things. It's hard to have statistics for earlier periods, but mm-hmm. The Department of Commerce expanded in the 20s and did all kinds of really handy studies for historians to use to look at business, the status of business in that period. In 1929, department stores had about 14 or 15% of the total retail trade, and that dropped down in the Depression to about 10%. But then it continued to decline, and so... It was a result of new forms of retailing that would be on the scene in the post-war period. And also downtown stores lost out to the branch stores. In 1966, about half of all department store sales were made in branch stores. So the downtown venues are losing out. By 1980, discount stores have really... the major ones that I mentioned that were founded in 1962, Target, Walmart, and Kmart, really had made inroads and had a lot of growth in the 70s and 80s. And in 1980, for example, only 40% of total department store sales were made by those conventional, traditional department stores. The rest were made by discount department stores.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of a tipping point. And... if you want to look at the total percent of retail trade, department stores, the conventional ones, I should say, had only about 3% of the total retail trade. So they went from their heyday, in the 20s, to having 14 or 15% of total retail trade to about 3%
uh-huh.
by 1980.
And so this is the long, drawn-out...
And since the 80s, it's even gone down further.
Right. Well, I mean, now we're in a position where... I guess Macy's is the one remaining. Would that be right?
Macy's is the largest department store chain.
In
the United States, and it is a chain. Chain means multi-unit.
Sure. Certain ones like Nordstrom has made the decision to go completely upscale. And in some ways exists still as a micro. Well, they're smaller than a traditional downtown department store, but they've maintained that sort of feel. And there's Macy's, and then I guess there's everybody else.
Yeah. I would count JCPenney's as, a department store, and that they're also suffering.
Yeah, deeply troubled at the moment. So what's what should be our takeaway from this this story? You are throughout the book trying to correct our nostalgia and for these department stores and correct it with some historical facts. But how should we think historically about the department store?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my I think my book is a comment on capitalism, you know, on the nature of capitalism, you know, using the department store as a lens to look at that. And I think that, you know, my argument is that, you know, things happen for a reason. They don't just happen because it's some sort of rational sort of evolution or it's an or it's some natural development. I would not argue that. As an historian, I look at contingency and paths not taken, and I try to historicize things. And the story of capitalism that emerges in my book is that things happen, you know, because various decisions and choices are made along the way. And the major players in my book are consumers and the businesses themselves, you know, the management policies. And then also what I'm really adding to the historiography is a call to look at the role of the state and the role of, what I mean by that is the role of government policies in shaping the status quo and shaping, you know, the world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout, that interplay of those three historical actors, the state, business, and consumers, has led to both the rise and the fall of the American department store. Yeah. And my book details that throughout the decades, leading us up to, you know, pretty much the present day.
It's very striking. I mean, Walmarts just don't happen because they're cheap.
Exactly. Test that is to look at other countries and see how things played out differently.
Right. I mean, the when a town puts in a Walmart, they're putting at least $500,000 of infrastructure in front of it. I know from other discussions I've heard or been part of that, you know, Walmart, when they speak to sort of professional appraisers meetings, which I can't imagine ever going to one, academic conference. Mm-hmm. Academic conferences are bad enough, but they're trying to argue you should only appraise us for a lifetime of 10 or 12 years, because that's as long as the store is going to last.
You mean the building itself?
Correct.
Yeah, I know there are all these big box stores and empty sort of cavernous warehouses all across the country.
And that's a part of the business plan. But it requires an act of the local government or of the state government or federal government in order to allow them to do that. So the rent-seeking behavior has gone on for quite. It's been part of the entire business history of the department store and then of the discounts.
Yes. Yeah. And it goes very far back.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I think we have come to the end of our time. Vicki Howard, this has been absolutely fascinating.
Well, thank you.
The book is From Main Street to Mall, The Rise and Fall of the American Department Store. And it's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Is it not?
Yes.
And it is hot off the laser printer or whatever they whatever they use.
Yeah, it came out last week.
Okay, well, best of luck with that. And
thank you. I appreciate you having me.
And thank you again for talking with us. Yes.
Goodbye.
For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.